And with that, I will kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris, and welcome everybody who could make it, I guess. I think we're missing quite a few people because of the power failure. Okay, so we'll start off by throwing it right back to Chris, who has a share for us.
Yeah, so I came across this, somebody, I think it was Paul Thurrott, mentioned that this is a relatively new addition to Google Street Views, that you can actually look at historical photos throughout the world. So Google Street Views has been working since 2007 to bring the street level images throughout the world. And as I said, you can now view past images. So next. So to get to Google Street View, the easiest way is just go to maps.google.com, and then down in the toolbar in the bottom right-hand corner, you'll have an icon that if you hover over top of it, it says Browse Street View Images. It looks like a little yellow icon of a person. If you click on that icon, you can drag it onto the map. Next. And you'll get these blue lines anywhere where there are street views are available. And so you can just drop the little person wherever you want to be able to see the street views, and you can move around from there. So the current street view, or the most recent street view that Google has, will appear on the screen. And you can use the arrow keys, left, right, up, down, to look around. You can click along the road. When you hover the mouse over top of the road, you'll get a chevron indicating that if you click there, it'll move you along the road. And so you can use those keys to navigate around. And next. You'll notice in the top left-hand corner, there is, I presume it's a new icon there. It looks like a clock. And if you click that icon, you'll actually get a thumbnail showing it'll show the current street view. And you'll have little dots that show you your other views that you can actually look at. And as you drag that big circle left or right, it'll actually show in the thumbnail this historical photo of that same location. And so when you drop it on any one of them, it'll stick on that on the thumbnail. And then you can just click the thumbnail and the bigger picture will switch to that that historical photo. So it's really kind of neat, and I think it's really good when you want to look at what a certain place looked at years ago. In this case, we had Carling and Marival. The oldest they had available, I think, was, well, actually, I think there's one older than this. That was June 2009. I could have gone back to one that was older than that even. And then the most recent was May 2021. And this helps if someone gives directions. Like, and I think this is supposed to be a real Ottawa thing, where people will say things like, turn right where the Lucky Key used to be. Really helpful thing if you are not familiar with the location of where Lucky Key used to be. But that seems to be a very Ottawa thing to do. And so that's it. So it's just a neat way that you can look at older photos in Google Street Views.
What, the Lucky Key not there anymore?
It's now a parking lot.
No parking lot.
Okay. And that's it. Thanks, Chris. Okay, moving along. I got a few things about smartphones. These are all questions that Micheline asked, and she was at Tim Hortons plugging their Wi-Fi earlier, but I don't think she's here right now. One of the questions was, how do you transfer files between a smartphone or an Android device and a personal computer? And there are basically two methods, probably a lot of people know. One is just to use a USB cable. So you have a regular USB and a micro USB. Micro USB goes in the phone and the regular one goes in the PC. And then what happens is Windows will see the device, and you can see here it's seen my old Motorola G6 smartphone in File Explorer. And however, you'll notice that it thinks that there is nothing on the phone. There are no files and folders being listed on the device. And the problem is that Android looks at the USB and thinks you want to charge things. So if you go into settings and connected devices and find the USB item, you'll notice that here it's set for charging this device. And this is obviously, again, it's not one of these Android things where it's dependent on the phone. If your manufacturer has customized Android, whichever Android version you have, that trying to find this thing can be interesting, to say the least. But then eventually you can click on that thing, and then you get a whole raft of other things that you can do. So here it's set for file transfer, or rather I've changed it from no data transfer, which is charge the phone, and I've activated this option here, file transfer. So now it will do both things. It will transfer files and charge. So now when I click on the File Explorer and I find the device, you can see now it sees two drives. It sees the internal storage on the phone, and it also sees a micro SD card that's plugged in to the phone. And if you check on one of those, then you can drill down to pictures and screenshots. And here are a couple of files. And now you're in Windows. So now you can highlight these files and drag them to somewhere else on the PC, all within File Explorer. So that's fine if you want to, if you can remember where your charging cable is, which is often an interesting problem, trying to hunt for the cable when you want to do file transfers. So I actually came across this software package called Software Data Cable. And as the name suggests, there's no cable involved now. You do everything in software. You use Software Data Cable to essentially establish an FTP connection between the phone and the PC. And then you need a file transfer client, FTP client. And I use FileZilla. And you load FileZilla onto the computer, and then that gives you the ability to actually transfer files to or from the smartphone and the computer. So the way it works, on the phone, you load the Software Data Cable app, and down the bottom here, you'll see that there's an icon that says computer, so you click on computer, and then if you hit on this blue button here, it's connect to the PC. However, when you do that, it doesn't actually make the connection. What it does is it gives you an IP address and a port. So this is the FTP server, essentially, which is set up on the phone. And what I need to do now is establish this as a connection in FileZilla. So we go to the PC now, and we run FileZilla. And what we need to do up here is this... these kind of three server type icons. This is called a site manager. So if you click on that, then I have some sites already set. What I want to do is create a new site for my smartphone. So I click on new site, and now it pops up this new icon here. So I'm going to type over, I'm going to call this new site smartphone. So when I do that, and then what I can do is I can take that IP address and the port that I had from the Software Data Cable, and also have it as being anonymous. I think I skipped on that. So I take the IP address, the port, and I set it to be anonymous so I don't have to deal with user IDs and passwords, because these are my two devices in a local connection mode. And now the trick is, once you've established all the credentials, rather than connecting right away, click on OK, because what that will do is it will save these credentials and it will add the smartphone to this list. So anytime I want to transfer files, I can just run FileZilla and call up my smartphone connection to make the actual connection between the two devices. All right, so now I've established my smartphone, so now I can click on smartphone, and now I can tell it, all right, I want to connect to the smartphone. So now I'm connecting the PC to the smartphone. So FileZilla works as a kind of a two-panel type file manager, if you like. So the left window here is the computer, and the right window over here is the phone. And you can see we've got various files and folders on both devices. So the first thing I want to do is go to the phone and drill down until I get to the folder where I want to transfer the files. So I'm going to grab some files from the phone, and I'm going to copy them over to this AGTemp2 folder on the computer. So I established that. Now I can go over here and drill down to pictures and screenshots, and there's a whole bunch of JPEG files here. So I highlight all the JPEG files that I want to transfer, and then I basically just drag and drop them into the AGTemp folder on the computer. And then FTP, FileZilla, does its magic and basically copies the files over. So now I've transferred the files from the smartphone to the PC. And clearly I can go both ways if I wish to do so. So there's a couple of different ways that I use to transfer files between my phone and my PC. And another thing that Micheline asked was, how do you select the speakerphone? And the answer to that is that you can only connect the speakerphone when you make or you answer a telephone call. So once you load the phone and you make a call or you answer a call, then this menu pops up here, so you can mute the phone or you can put the caller on hold. And right here, this icon is the speakerphone. So if you click on this, then instead of using the mic and the phone, you're actually using it as a speakerphone. And so you'll hear the other side of the conversation without essentially holding the phone to your ear. And you can see here that I'm using one of Chris's contacts, this guy here that he was talking about last week. And the second thing that Micheline wanted to know was, your car breaks down and it's really bright and you can't see the icons on the touchscreen because the sun's too bright. So how do you call the tow truck? And I thought about this, and I think one of the things you could do, I mean, there might be other way, maybe somebody's had this happen to them, and maybe you know the answer. One of the things you could do is use the Google Assistant, because she's listening there, and you just say, "Hey, Google," just like you would with an Alexa-type device at home. You say, "Hey, Google," to your phone, and then you can use Chris's contact list again and call that nefarious towing company guy. So you say, "Call creepy guy," and she immediately goes back and says, "Sorry, who do you want to call?" Because of course I don't have this creepy guy. I must get that guy's number from Chris, and then I guess I could call him using Google Assistant. So I don't know if anybody else has got a bright idea in terms of how to do that, but it struck me that was one way to get around the bright sunlight problem. The other thing to do is buy a phone that's got a much brighter screen, I guess. And that's one of the problems with phones. You go to the store and you see this really nice screen, and you buy the phone for hundreds of dollars, you take it home, and as soon as you take it outside, you can't see anything because it's actually not really bright enough. So should have paid some more money and bought a better phone, I guess.
Yeah, okay. one of the ideas on that, I guess, as Linda just mentioned, that a lot of people have their screen turned down pretty low because it's draining the battery if you have it turned up really bright. So one of the things might be, too, that if you just know what buttons to press to brighten the screen might help as well.
Yeah, that can be. But even that, on some phones, you can't get it bright enough. Real problem.
In an emergency, you can always grab a coat or a sweater or something and put it over your head with the phone underneath it to shield the sun out and get your emergency calls in.
Yeah, good idea.
It's sort of bush league, but it gets the job done.
That's the old photography trick, is it, Bob?
Exactly.
Okay, I see Bill says that to transfer files between the devices, he uses Dropbox. So that's basically using an intermediate cloud storage server to transfer the files on an intermediate basis. Okay, Chris has got another share here on file history.
Yeah, so anybody who knows how I operate, you know that I really like file history. I think it's a really, really good capability. What it does is it's built into Windows 10 and above. Actually, it goes back before 10 even. But they keep improving it as well, so it works more reliably. It gives you near real-time backup of new and changed files. The most frequent you can do is have it check every 10 minutes to every day for new and changed files, and then it'll back them up to a backup drive. You also get version control. So as you modify files, every time it does its run and it says, oh, I got a new version of it, it'll keep the old versions so that you can go back to an old version if you want. And potentially you can have years worth of previous versions of files, because typically the files that you're doing this on are like data files, you know, documents and spreadsheets and things like that, which are typically not huge. And so, you know, it's no big deal if you have a file that is even, say, 10 megabytes and you're modifying it every day. You know, you could have years worth of it without impacting too much your backup drive. It is really easy to recover files. I do have an article in the newsletter that is on the screen that if you wanted to read more about how to work with file history. Next. Okay, but then I thought, well, what if you're upgrading to a new computer? So it would be really nice if you could preserve those old versions of files. It's easy enough to start a new file history and get, you know, the most recent version of your files that you want to preserve. But what about those old versions? Well, you can do it, but it's not actually quite so straightforward as I thought. So on the new computer, you connect your file history drive from the old computer. So the file history works only if it's a separate drive on your computer. And if it happened to be another internal drive on it, you can actually just copy the contents of the file history folder on that particular drive to an external drive and then plug that external drive into the new computer. Then you run Control Panel and File History. Don't use the Settings app. So the Settings app, you go to Update and Security, Backup Using File History. That's the normal way to use the program, and that's the way that you get all of the options and so forth. But it will not give you the controls that you actually need to transfer this to a new computer. So you have to do it through Control Panel, File History. So when you get there, you click on the option there for Configure File History Settings. There is a chance that you may not see that dialog box. I've tried this on a couple of computers, and in some circumstances, it'll just jump to the next dialog box. But if you have to, you click on that, then you might get this second dialog box just automatically. So don't click the box that says turn on. If you do that, what you're going to end up with is on that file history drive, you'll get a new file history backup set. And you will not get the option ever again to actually go back and get the old file history. So don't click that next. What you do is you click on that box that says, I want to use a previous backup on this file history drive. This is the option that you will not get if you go through the settings app to set up file history. So you have to go in here, check that box, and then it'll come up with a list of the file histories that are on that or that backup drive. It'll find the backup drive and it'll show the file history on there. And then what you want to do is it'll say, we're going to use that previous file history backup, which is exactly what you want. And at that point, you click on turn on. And then you will end up selecting the file, the existing backup, which will be in the list, and then you click on the turn on. Sorry, I mixed up my slides there a little bit. You can click the run now. It'll probably actually start running automatically. But if it doesn't, you can go ahead and click run now. It'll actually back up quite quickly because it's a new computer. You don't have all your old files on it. It'll actually create a new backup, which will be integrated into the previous file history. You don't have to do that if it doesn't come up. Then to get that your old history files, what you can do is click on in the left-hand panel, Restore Personal Files. And when you do that, the most recent backup will show. Now, this is the backup of the new computer that you just ran or ran. It ran automatically when you clicked on the turn on button. But then you see down at the bottom, you have the VCR type controls where you can go back to previous ones. And you can see I'm a big fan of here because in this example, I got 9,950 backups that I've run on my computer. So next. So you click the left arrow once, and that'll get back to the last backup, which will be from the previous computer. Click on there, and you'll see that the files are actually different. So in this case here, because I hadn't configured on the new computer special, it just came up with the default set of folders, whereas on the old computer, I had actually configured it to do specific folders, 2021, 2022, documents, favorites, Google Drive, and the Orleans Photo Club and music were the seven folders that I'm backing up on an ongoing basis on my current computer. Now, if you want, you can actually restore that entire set of files to your new computer. So there are other ways of doing it, and I suspect that most people are actually going to try and get back your data files other ways if you have proper backups, but you can restore them all that way if you want to. So to restore all the files, don't select anything in that dialog box at all. Click the restore button and all of the files, the folders, everything from there will get restored to their original location. And that's a critical thing, original location. Next. What if, say on the old computer, I'm backing up something that was on the Z drive and on the new computer, I don't have a Z drive. So it starts to do the restores and it comes across this and says, well, I can't restore that because the original location is not available. But you do have a restore to button where it'll pop up and it'll allow you to say, oh, okay, I want to restore this somewhere else. Now, this could get real tedious if you've got 10,000 files or something like that that were on the Z drive that don't exist on the new one. So if you run into a case like that, you might actually go in and temporarily set up a Z drive on that computer just to get the files over. Okay. It is the only way to access files from old file history if the drive is not available. It's going to come up with that restore to option. Or you can actually press the Windows key and the R and type in file history, and it'll bring up that same dialog box. Next. So if you've already restored your files from your old computer another way, you don't have to go through all of that. So most commonly you'll find that with regular backups. So if you have an image backup of your computer, you might use that image backup to restore all of your data files onto the newer computer. So there's no need to actually restore from your file history. They both will functionally do the same thing. It's just that file history, you might not be backing up all of your files. You might only be backing up the files that you find to be most critical. And so if you do from a regular backup, you're more likely to be getting all of your files. But you can still access the file history to get to previous versions of your files. So you can do that just by right-clicking on any file, and you go to Properties, and then there is a Previous Versions tab. And you can see on here, I've got all of these Q&A PPTX files, which are the decks from Q&A, going back months and months and months, and I could restore any one of those. So it's a really, really handy way to preserve that old file history on your computer. Next. So one of the other things you want to do is configure file history, because just restoring your or grabbing that backup set doesn't configure file history to actually back up the same set of files. So most people do customize their settings of file histories, most notably things like how often to backup, how long to keep your backups, what folders that you actually want to include or exclude. So on the new computer, make sure you do go into file history, go in this time, go to settings, update and security, backup, more options. And I would guess that in most cases, you probably want to match that from your old computer. So I'd bring up the settings on your old computer and then bring it up on the new computer and then just make the settings match or however you want them to actually be configured on the new computer. Next. Final slide. Remember, file history, I think, is a really, really good solution for near real-time backup of new and changed files, and the ability to potentially keep years worth of versions of your data files, so that if you corrupt one or you just want to get back to a version that you were working on last week or last month or last year, to be able to get that really, really fast and easy, it's great. Remember, though, the file history is not a substitute for an image backup on your computer. The image backup on your computer, Alan and I both talked about this extensively, it backs up the operating system, your programs, and your data so you can get it back to a working state. It is also not a substitute for offsite backup of your computer. So that'll protect against things like fires, tornadoes, or power outages that go on for extended periods of time. So that's it. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Okay, there was nothing in the chat on that. So okay. Our next item is from Bob Walker. So Bob, if you want to set up your thing. Does somebody have a question there?
Nothing in the chat.
Okay. And one of the things that Stuart mentioned, kind of on Linda's point, in terms of dimmed screens, I guess, is that a lot of phones have adaptive screen brightness, and that can actually reduce the brightness of the screen too. So sometimes it's good to turn that off and then crank the brightness right the way up. Okay, all yours, Bob.
Okay, before I start my presentation, here's a shout out to Art Hunter. A few years back, Art gave us a great presentation on his Ottawa Microgrid Energy Freedom Project. And since then, I had a great tour of his place and all the technology he has. And the picture in the corner of this slide here doesn't come to anywhere close to showing all the wonderful things he has. If you go to if you download the deck here and click on the Microgrid Energy Freedom Project, there's all sorts of wonderful pictures of the stuff. But in the aftermath of Saturday storm, Art ran extension cords throughout his neighborhood to power fridges, freezers. He set up a big charging station in his driveway for everyone's electronics. He actually had the charging station set up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and by 6:30 there were people plugging their stuff in. There's a great story on this at the Ottawa Citizen site about the Manitic Man powers his neighborhood with microgrid house. And there's a picture there of Art's command and control room. And right there, there's three Tesla Powerwall batteries. And each of these is just an awesome source of power. Also, in light of Saturday's storm, just a reminder that last August and September, I gave two different presentations on backup power sources. One was solar charging for your smartphone and other devices, and the other is other backup power sources. And I've included the links there if you want to review that and maybe start preparing for the next time around. Okay, so in light of my video and audio tools series, tonight I'm going to be talking about WisdomSoft's Screen Hunter Pro all-in-one screen capture and screen recording software. And there's a link at the bottom of the page there on to their website. Screen Hunter can do a lot of things, including some image editing and webcam captures, as well as image and video captures. A lot of the functionality Screen Hunter has overlaps with the functionality of the debut video capture and screen recording software I looked at previously. And you may find that just one of them can meet your needs. Screen Hunter started out as an image capture software and expanded out and did video and a lot of other things. And Debut started out as a video capture software and moved towards doing image capture and some other things as well. So there's some overlap there, but each is best in its area of specialty. Tonight we're going to focus on the basics of using Screen Hunter to do basic image and video screenshots. Now there's all sorts of wonderful features and functionality, and I'm not going to go into it here, first of all, because the table is pretty hard to read with everything in there. But if you click on the link there to go to the features comparison on the website, it compares the free, the plus, and the pro versions. And tonight I'm going to be covering basically the pro version, although the functionality is similar. And on the same web page, there's some extra information on the features and functionality. Pricing wise, the free version, you download it and install it, and that's probably going to be all they ask for. Officially, there's a $3.99 charge for it once you get past the trial period, but I haven't had that be a problem yet. The pro version is basically $30 US, and that's a one-time fee. It's not one of these annual fee type of things. All of the versions have a 30-day trial period, so you download it, install it, try it free for 30 days, and after 30 days, the plus and the pro version will either limit the functionality or sort of go brain dead on you. As far as alternative to Screen Hunter goes, there's all sorts of different screen capture, screenshot, video capture, et cetera, apps out there. And I've looked at, you know, the all of the best of reviews, you know, best 10 screen capture products, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's just a whole mishmash, and no two reviews seem to list the same applications. So two you might want to consider besides Screen Hunter are GreenShot and Snagit. And I know there's some members of the club tonight that are here that use either or both of those. We're going to look at the initial install and setup first. First off, Screen Hunter downloads and installs like most other Windows applications. There's no surprises or anything there. The settings on the following slides are my suggested settings just to start, but feel free to play with them once you get used to the basics, or if you see settings that might better meet your specific needs. First of all, this is the main screen for Screen Hunter Pro. And right now, if you look up on the left side there, you'll see it's on the capture screen. And on this screen, there's a hotkeys bar here, and you can tick off use hotkeys. And the default hotkey for capturing images is F6, and you can change that if you want. But I usually recommend going with the defaults on these sort of things unless it conflicts with another application you're using. The second thing is in the screen area here, you want to click off rectangular area. That way you get to choose the area of the screen that you're going to do the capture on. There's also a fixed area where you can set a specific area of your screen for each and every capture. That's something you'd rarely want to use, where you can tick off window, in which case you'll capture the active window. Full screen means you'll capture the full screen when you do the capture. And then there's a setting down here, auto scroll, and this is for images only, not for videos. And it allows you to scroll down a web page to capture the entire web page. Up here under Add, if you tick off cursor here, the cursor will show if it's in the capture area of the screen. So if you're capturing full screen, the cursor is definitely going to show up somewhere. If you untick this, the cursor, even though you can see it, won't appear in the capture. On the save image section here, where is it here? In the send images too, you want to tick off clipboard. And that means as well as sending the capture image to your chosen location, it'll also send it to the clipboard. So until you send something else to the clipboard, you can do a paste of that image somewhere else. The image files section here under format, it's best to start off with JPEG. If you tick off all these boxes, you'll have six different save files because it will save a file in each and every format. And the default is JPEG and PNG. So you want to untick the PNG to start with. And file name is automatic. It'll name it something like Screen Hunter. Well, in this case, you know, and a sequential number. And then you want to put in here where you want the files to go. And something like C users, username, documents, my files, and screenshots is a good thing to start. So you want to set up that directory first and then use the browse here to select it for the application. Under save video, the main thing is you want to have it ticked off to capture the sound as well as the video or the visual part. And for format, you want to select MP4. That's a very common format. All the viewers can handle it. The FLV or Flash video, that's a pretty old format, and it's sort of going the way of the dodo bird. Again, the file name is automatic, and you select the place where you want it to go. You might want to have it the same directory as the image files with the additional slash videos to start out so you can keep them separate. On the options, you want to have the application start minimized. You want to have it run on Windows startup. And you want it to show the tooltips. When you hover over something, it'll tell you what it's for. When capturing, you want to have it show the crosshairs, and you'll see how necessary this is in a minute. Show a flashing indicator while it's recording videos. And during the capture process, if things start to go south, you can press escape to cancel it and try again. And then after capturing, if you want, you can tick off this. It'll play a sound when it's finished capturing. The sound is sort of like an old style camera shutter. And under tools, there's not much to say here, unless you start getting into other stuff like the image editor and the webcam captures. But it's on this screen that if you decide to buy a copy, you enter the license information and you check for upgrades. So after you finish all that initial setup, you restart the computer and you'll see a white bar along the top of the screen, and the Screen Hunter icon will be active in the taskbar. Now you can right-click on that icon and you'll see that you can click on X to deactivate it, and I'll show you that right now. Down here, here's the Screen Hunter icon. I hover over it, and you get this little window popping up, and you just go up the top, click X, and close it, because you don't really need that window there, and I'll show you why in just a second. When you hover the mouse cursor over that white bar at the top of the screen, what they call the desktop toolbar drops down, and it includes a hamburger menu there to bring up a larger menu. It also has the Capture Now button, so you click on that to capture an image. It has the Record Now button to capture a video, and I've never used this fourth thing here, the unpin pin button. If you click on that, it unpins the desktop toolbar, and you can move it over to some other edge or somewhere else on the top edge and then re-pin it. But I find it's just handy in the middle of the top edge of the screen. In the desktop toolbar hamburger menu, if you click on that, it brings up this menu here, and you can hide the desktop toolbar or do some other settings or whatever, or actually quit Screen Hunter altogether. The main thing I use it for is to bring up the main window if I want to fiddle with any of the settings. So under the capture a rectangular area of your screen, during the initial setup, we selected a rectangular area, and this enables us you to select a specific rectangular area of the screen for your image and video captures. And you'll probably be using this setting the most, at least at first. So we're going to cover this. And later on, you may want to explore doing captures for the full screen, just the active window, or while scrolling through a web page. And you can find all sorts of directions and instructions for doing this at the URL there. And Chris will be posting all the URLs in this presentation onto the chat bar there. So under this URL, there's all sorts of quick how-tos, step-by-step instructions. And as well, if you go to YouTube and search for Screen Hunter, there's all sorts of videos to show you how to do things. So if you're going to capture a rectangular image of the screen, first of all, you either press the hotkey, in this case F6 by default, or you hover the mouse cursor over the white bar at the top, and when the desktop toolbar drops down, you click on the Capture Now button, or if the main Screen Hunter window is open, you click on the Capture Now button, and when you do either of these things, a set of crosshairs with a detail window will appear. And you see that here, there's the detail window, and there's where the crosshairs intersect. And you move the crosshairs up to a corner of the image you want to capture. The detail window there will show you like a super enlargement of the immediate crosshair area, so you can fine tune the position. When the crosshairs are positioned exactly where you want, click and hold down the left mouse button, and then drag to select the area on the screen that you want to capture. And when you get to the diagonal opposite corner, again, you can use the detail window there to fine-tune it. And when you let go of the mouse button, boom, the capture is done. If the after capture playing sound was selected during the setup, you'll hear a camera shutter sound. So you now have an image capture of a rectangular area of your choice, and the file will be wherever you chose during the setup. If during all this, where you're trying to position the crosshairs and it's just not working out the way you want, you can hit escape and then try again. And I'd be glad to show you this live, except that there's a zoom bar at the top blocking my access to the white toolbar. So let me try F6. There we go. There are the crosshairs. There's the detail window. I'm going to go up, get this corner here, drag it down. Hit the bottom corner, let go of the button. You probably heard the camera shutter sound, and I've now captured this section of the screen in the chosen directory. Now, there's another setting there that under the capture screen. Under screen, adjust, there's a box. And if that was clicked during setup, the capture will not happen when you release the mouse button. What will happen is you'll see a section of the screen there where the area you selected is squared out with little handles to grab it, and you can adjust that on the image until you get it exactly where you wanted. And then when you hit the camera button here, the capture now button, the image will be captured. Or you just press enter on your keyboard. And again, if things aren't going the way you want, you can hit escape and try again.
Bob, quick question before you go on. When you're first dragging the box out, can you also use the arrow keys on your keyboard to do fine adjustments? I know most screen capture programs allow you to do that so that each tap on the arrow keys, it'll move it just pixel by pixel.
I've never actually tried that. You can use the arrow buttons when you have this adjustment box called up, and you can use the arrow buttons for that. You just sort of highlight the particular handle you want and use the arrow buttons. But I've never tried it in the quick and dirty capture stage.
That's a pretty cool feature to be able to adjust it before you do the final capture. I haven't seen that in Snagit or GreenShot. They'll allow you to adjust as you're dragging the bounding box, pixel by pixel, but not adjusting it after you finish the box. Neat.
Yeah, it's a nice feature. I like that white bar at the top too, because you can just off the cuff, boom, in 2 seconds, you've got a capture of something you see on a website. Without going through a lot of other hoo-ha. And, go look at capturing a video now. Now, with an image, you hit F6 by default, or you hover the mouse cursor over the white bar at the top of the screen, and the desktop toolbar drops down. In this case, you hit the Record Now button, which is the button on the right. Or if you have the main screen hunter window open, click on the Record Now button. And then the rest is very similar. You move the crosshairs to a corner of the image. You can use the enlarged crosshairs window for fine adjustments of the position. When the crosshairs are positioned where you want, you click and hold down the mouse button, drag it to the diagonally opposite corner. of where you want to capture. And then you, when you release the mouse button, the capture will start. And you see in this image here, there's the video window. In this case, this particular video player has the controls in the bottom of the window. In this case, you can see the little corner things here. These will flash while it's recording. And in this case, I've positioned it to show the whole video window. You could position it to just show the part minus the control bar if you want to crop that out. Once you start the capture, similar to the debut video capture last week, once you start the capture, then you start the video playing, or if the video is already playing, you reset it back to the beginning, and then let it play. So in this case, you're going to get a little bit of garbage at the beginning, and you'll end up with the same sort of thing at the end. Now, when the video finishes playing, you hit the stop button here, and that ends it, ends the capture. Now, if this little bit of garbage at the beginning or the end is something you really can't stand, you can use a video editor like Shotcut to edit the garbage out. And again, if you have the capture screen adjust box checked during setup, you can adjust the area and then start the video capture by clicking on the video now button. And let's try a live version of this. I'm going to, where am I here? Got this Zoom toolbar across the top driving me crazy here. Okay, so let's look at this here. Here's the video. I'm going to hit F8 to start the capture. Let me drag it across. Let go. Okay, as the capture has started, I'm going to reset it to beginning and let it play. When it's finished, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not going to do the whole video here and bore you all, but when it's got as far as you want, hit the stop button and you're done. Okay, a few caveats here or warnings. Once you click on the capture now or the record now buttons, you don't want to move the mouse cursor anywhere until the crosshairs have come up, and that might take a second or two, because if you get excited and you move the cursor near where you want to start out defining the capture or moving the crosshairs, you might capture the cursor in the screen there in your capture. Another thing is, without using this software or any other software, you can capture many images by right-clicking on the image and selecting Save Image As or Copy Image, And likewise, you can right-click on many videos and select Save Video As. So you don't even need the software to do some of this. I suggest using the trial version of whatever version of Screen Hunter you're looking at to see if it meets your needs before buying. Don't just buy right off the top. There's a bunch of URLs here. If you download the deck, this is all the URLs that were mentioned during the presentation. And I believe Chris has pasted them into the chat window as well.
Yep, they're all there.
And so next time we'll look at how to capture or rip audio from a video file and how to take a screenshot from a video using the GOM player. And there's free and paid for versions of this, and we'll discuss that next time around. And that's it for now.
We have a question from Serge Eric. How is the image editor in Screen Hunter for image annotations and arrows and such?
It's fairly good. It's the sort of quality you expect in most of the image capture products. I haven't really used it that much, but it's fairly easy to use and pretty much the same as most of the rest. So definitely comparable to the ones in Snagit. The ones that Snagit has some better image editing and capabilities, but it's the flip side is it's more expensive if you pay for it. So that's why I went with Screen Hunter in the first place, because at the time I first started using Screen Hunter, Snagit was enormously more expensive, and the free version of Screen Hunter was a lot more capable.
Okay, I think that's all the questions we have. So,
yeah, thanks. Thanks very much, Bob. We'll look forward to your thing next week. So we're at that time. It's almost the witching hour, but if anybody has any other questions, now is the time to ask them. And we don't have the capability to unmute everybody, so you have to unmute yourself, I think, if you want to ask something. I'll put something in the chat window. And while you're all thinking about it, I'll do my wrap-up. Just to remind you that the OPCUG Tech Talk on Scam Avoidance and Trust is on Monday, June the 6th, and you'll need to register to get the logon credentials if you wish to attend that. Our next regular meeting isn't going to be an actual meeting, a computer meeting anyway. It's going to be our pizza queue. So we're going to Vincent Matty Park on the 8th of June. And just a note that we'll be starting at 6 and the pizza will be arriving at 6:30. At 6:30. So if you show up at 7:30, there may not be any pizza left. And looking forward into the fall, the first meeting in the fall will be September the 14th, and it's going to be a member's favorite session. And you probably all know what that is. Any computer-related topic, an application that you really like, a really neat piece of kit that you've bought, or some kind of tweak to one of the operating systems. We're looking for just a few minutes presentation. Most of them seem to be 10 to 20 minutes. And again, if you have anything you want to share with the group, then just send us a note to the suggestion box address and we'll reserve you a spot. And just on a kind of a general note, we're looking for topics. So if you have topics for monthly meetings or you have things that you'd like to hear about at Q&A, we're always interested to find out about those things. So anything that you can think of, just let us know. If you can't provide it, then we'll see if we can find somebody who can. no promises, but we always try to cover everybody's suggestions. And then the final thing I have is on June the 1st, which is next week, next month, next Wednesday, our Q&A as usual. So if you have questions or topics that you want to share, then suggestion box at opcug.ca.
And there's a question from Timothy. Is it live or Zoom in September? Current plans are that it's going to be Zoom. We haven't got any plans yet to go back to live meetings other than the pizza party.
Yeah, we haven't heard from the church yet, so they're not prepared to let anybody in, so we can't schedule anything right now. But it will definitely be Zoom if we don't have a face-to-face meeting. And it may be both if we can have a face-to-face meeting. The plan is that we're going to try and dual boot, as it were, and have a live meeting with a live feed. So that should be interesting, technically challenging. Okay, so that's our hour for today, and I hope everybody enjoyed the session. Again, if you have anything you want to know about or share next week, send us a note. And other than that, I hope everybody gets their power back. And we'll see you all next week.